اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's called the Police, Crime, Sentencing, and Courts Bill. If passed through Parliament, the bill will give more power to the police to shut down demonstrations and protesters, could even face prison, which could make peaceful protests and marches a thing of the past. Why did the UK Home Secretary suggest such a bill in the first place? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether this bill represents a massive assault on civil liberties and other aspects of this bill, which have been called a violation of human rights.
Soon, this might be illegal in the UK. Holding a banner, beating a drum, and raising your voice in protest. The government's controversial Police, Crime, Sentencing, and Courts Bill is currently being debated at the House of Lords. If passed, any non-violent public assembly could be snuffed out.
There is a sense of impending doom. People here fear an Orwellian scenario in which democracy as they know it, although flawed, will become a thing of the past.
The new police powers would set conditions on the duration of protests, noise levels and locations. The British feel the walls are closing in on them, manifesting in more than just this bill.
We've got the worst poverty in Europe. We're most of us unequal country in Europe. And we have one of the highest death rates from COVID in Europe as a result. Its treatment of migrants is absolutely appalling.
These are the citizens of the UK saying, we want to, we demand that we live in a free country. We are all here to defend ourselves, our rights, and journalists and publishers like Julian Assange who speak up and tell us what our governments are doing.
The bill also proposes to introduce new laws that penalise stopping on private and public land without authorisation. This would have the effect of criminalising the way of life of Gypsy, Roma and Traveller people.
This is an attack on our right to protest. It's an attack on Gypsy, Roma and Travellers people's right to live, where they've lived in their way of living for like time immemorial. We're seeing more stringent rules, more brutal rules being brought in, more strong policing powers, not just here, but around the world. We're seeing the Zionists upping the ante on the Palestinian people.
All of our struggles are connected, and we're representing the Arab people, and representing the fight against the state and against people's ability to speak against the state is crucial wherever we are.
The Tory government is fishing in murky waters, taking advantage of distractions like the pandemic to push through draconian laws like the police bill and the borders and nationality bill. But the people out on London's streets say they have the government sussed and won't stand for it. Bianca Rahimi, London.
We're guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. First, we have human rights activist and campaigner Natalie Strecker joining us from Jersey, Channel Islands. Also joining us, former British MP Chris Williamson, who joins us from Derby, the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Looking at those scenes in those protests were pretty telling. So I'm going to start with you, Natalie Strecker, if I may. It's called Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill. Huge piece of legislation covering many aspects of the UK criminal justice system. Perhaps you can tell us what the controversial aspects of it are.
Well, I would say that there's probably too many to mention this evening. I mean, obviously, in effect, it outlaws protest. We see the targeting of minority groups, the legislation that will impact the Gypsy, Roma and Traveller community, which we need to remember is one of the most discriminated communities within the UK, not just in recent years, but actually since medieval times. And I think when we talk about the Gypsy, Roma and Traveller community, it's important to remember them in the context more widely of Europe, and how alongside the Jews they were the only other people that were identified as a group for extermination. And I think it's really important to remind people of that as we think about how this bill will impact them. But there's lots of other things. As per usual we see very ambiguous language used about the outlawing of people attaching themselves to things and to people. But what does attach mean? Does it mean just when you observe people locking themselves in, as you quite often see at arms factories and arms fairs, or does it also possibly mean people linking arms? So I think that there's numerous aspects of this bill, and actually amendments that I'm not even aware of as yet, of course, which have been added since before it went into the House of the Lords. So I think it's deeply concerning legislation and violates our human and civil rights on all levels.
Sure. Chris Williamson, I'm wondering what the thinking behind this was. I'm not sure if you can answer this, but, you know, was it something that they actually looked at to initially target certain segments of the British society, perhaps? For example, the ones who come out in protest, for example, the Roma, for example, minorities. Is that the approach, perhaps, that was used? Because it sure looks that way. And leading to the question, which seems to be the most controversial one, and that is to ban marches and demonstrations because they believe that it might seriously, and I don't know if I read this correctly, seriously disruptive, including being too noisy?
Well, I mean, I think the neoliberal capitalist system in this country is broken down. It isn't working, and people are fed up and are increasingly wanting to express their concerns about the way democracy operates in this country. We have a climate catastrophe on the horizon. People are rightly concerned about that. The government isn't acting swiftly enough to deal with that. We see racism and bigotry increasing in this country. We've seen the emergence of the Black Lives Matter campaigners. And obviously this has sent a shiver down the spine, it seems to me, of the establishment, because people are flexing their muscles. They are using the democratic right to demonstrate and to put pressure on the government. And it seems to me that this is an attempt to squash protest and to, you know, prevent these sort of inconvenient truths being highlighted on the streets. And this is a very dangerous and slippery slope, it seems to me, when we're talking about potentially jailing people for, you know, up to a year because, you know, they're protesting and you know, police don't like the noise or the route that they wish to take on a march, for example. And I think the other proposition to potentially jail people for 10 years for defacing or damaging memorials. But we saw this last year or the year before, I think it was, where a slave trader who'd been venerated in Bristol had this statue torn down and thrown into the river. And obviously people are rightly upset and concerned about the way in which Britain's imperialist past is actually promoted and exalted. And it seems to me people have an absolute right to challenge that. And the government are seeking to prevent this and to clamp down in the most repressive way possible. I mean, this is reminiscent of a tin pot dictatorship, not the country which is supposed to pride itself on democracy.
Sure, but Priti Patel seems to think that this is okay, and I'm wondering what you would tell her, Natalie Strecker, when she says, yes, peaceful protest remains a cornerstone of democracy, but argues that there has been a significant change in protest tactics. So she's coming in on protest tactics through that angle, in which she says protesters are exploiting gaps in the law.
Obviously, there's lots of things I would say to Priti Patel, but probably most of them are not appropriate at this moment whilst being interviewed. I guess what I would say is if we just need to look at our history, you know, if I speak as a female, how was it we gained our rights just to be able to vote and to be seen as equals within society was only possible through the tactics that are being used currently today. You know, that women had to take themselves on the streets, take direct action to be noisy. You know, there isn't, the problem is, you know, if we look at the other tactics, quite often you'll have people sit down and sign petitions, but we know that no change really comes without people being noisy. And that's one of our rights. And, you know, I've spoken about women's suffrage, but also the civil rights movement, you know, the movement to end the slave trade. I think that Priti Patel needs, quite often, they'll talk about, you know, in November near Remembrance Day, the importance of the sacrifices our soldiers, grandparents made in order to gain our freedoms. They talk about this a lot, and yet, you know, at this very moment, they're looking at removing those freedoms that were fought for. So are they really honouring the sacrifices they make when they're looking at bringing such draconian laws? And listening to what Chris said about a tin pot dictatorship, you know, I would say Priti Patel is a tin pot dictator. And I think it's not just authoritarian. It's actually fascist that we see ourselves slipping into the UK. It's really good. I would encourage people to look up the warning signs of fascism, which is in a Holocaust museum. And it highlights the different steps. And we have ticked pretty much all of those steps now. So it is really frightening times, just as ordinary human beings who want to take a stance for things that are important to us. And what I would add is that this isn't even a left-right issue. It comes down to whether we believe in basic freedom of speech, whether we believe in the protection of our civil liberties and individual liberties.
Indeed. That's the point that has been made. We're going to talk about that in a broader respect when it comes to the UK, but I can't help but also look at this, Chris Williamson, in terms of some of the not only most colorful protests, but some of the most vociferous and large-scale protests that have taken place in the UK over the years, which has to deal with the issue of Palestine. And I'm wondering, given the close relationship that this government, especially Priti Patel, has with Israel, that do you think that this could be one of the driving forces that maybe led as an incentive to come up with the laws and provisions behind this?
Well, I'm sure that featured in their thinking. I don't think that was the only factor, but I'm sure that certainly was one of them. You're absolutely right. And it's not just Priti Patel, of course, that's very close to the Israeli apartheid regime. I mean, you know, the vast majority of parliamentarians are supporters of the apartheid state of Israel. Half the members of the Parliamentary Labour Party, which is supposed to be the party that stands up for civil rights and democracy and anti-imperialism, and yet around 50% of the Parliamentary Labour Party are members of an organisation called Labour Friends of Israel. So yes, certainly. And I think now, because in this modern age of smartphones and so on, what we're seeing is citizen journalism taking place in Gaza, and, you know, young people who have learnt good English in the UN schools there are able to use their smartphones and then to upload those images onto the internet, which actually illustrate the absolute barbarity of the Israeli regime and the propaganda that we are relentlessly subjected to in this country and have been, you know, ever since Israel was established back in 1948. And much of the atrocities that they perpetrated were unknown to the British people. Well, that's no longer the case. And the bombardment that we saw against Gaza in the spring of last year saw people coming onto the streets in this country in unprecedented numbers, and not just in the capital either. Up and down the country, small towns and large cities in the provinces saw people coming onto the streets. In my own city of Derby, which is a modest-sized city, it saw the biggest demonstration in Derby's history in support of the Palestinian people. Now, of course, this is something which, you know, the government, it seems to me, are not prepared to tolerate.
Sure.
And I'm sure that this will be used, if these measures are successfully put onto the statute book, to limit the ability of people to, highlight the atrocities of the Israeli regime and to support the Palestinian people. But, of course, it goes much wider than that. And, you know, we've seen the Insulate Britain activists in this country who have been drawing attention to the scandal of fuel poverty, with millions of people struggling to heat their homes, having to make desperate choices between eating adequately or heating their homes adequately. And there's all sorts of health conditions. Thousands of people die every single year in this country, in the fifth biggest economy in the world, because they can't afford to heat their homes properly, let alone the impact of climate change is having on the way of life of people, if indeed nothing is done to actually, you know, address that. And so,
sure,
you know, they are taking direct action methods. I mean, and Natalie talked about the role of the suffragettes and the direct action that they engaged in. And
sure,
you know, direct action has an absolute and important role to play in a democracy, and it's through direct action actually that many of the advances that we made in this country in terms of democratic rights for the citizens of Britain has been brought about in the first instance as a consequence of direct action. And
sure,
this is a real attempt to try and, you know, stifle it and prevent it. But I'm sure they won't succeed. And, you know, it'll make people more determined. But what we will see is our prisons filling up.
Okay.
Of course, there's an issue there because all of our prisons have been privatised. So there's money to be made out of imprisoning people in this country. It's an absolute scandal. The system is completely broken in this country, and people are waking up to that. And regrettably, we've got establishment parties on both sides,
right,
of the chamber in Parliament who are not really speaking up for the people. So people are taking to the streets to actually make their voices heard. And as I say, this is an attempt to stop them having their voices heard and the pressure being applied.
Well, that's the whole issue here, Natalie Strecker. I think our guest there, in a sense, nailed it on the head when Chris Williamson said that this is not going to stop people from coming out. We could talk about what may amount as the protests take place, and then the police make decisions as to whether these protests are following any guidelines or not. But I'd like to take a look at the bigger picture there in the UK when it comes to just freedom, when it comes to the whole notion of democracy, because you in a sense talk about how this is becoming a fascist state, perhaps authoritarian. I think you used the word dictatorship. I know that the UK has, by some accounts, been compared to being a police state. Maybe that also leads the lines that you were speaking about the UK in terms of the freedom being chipped away at. This is a big strike to freedom in the UK. What are the consequences that we're going to see as a result of this? What other areas can you name for us, if you can?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's going to impact every area of our life, you know, because a lot of this is about whether the police agree for you having a protest or the government. Well, it's if the government agrees with it, then it's not really a protest, is it? It's a parade. And I think it's important to kind of remember that. But, Chris quite rightly said before about the different things that are, you know, society is unraveling as we see the collapsing of capitalism, the neoliberal project, as we see ecological breakdown, escalating. This is going to cause more and more unrest. So in terms of freedoms, if people don't have the right to go out on the streets, then it's going to impact other freedoms, the freedom and the right to life, you know, the right to security and all these other things. I think it's deeply concerning, but also how it will impact education that takes place, you know, the sense of, you know, the personal agency that we have as individuals. I think there are so many ways that this will impact us. And of course, we're focusing on a policing bill, but there are other bills that have been brought in already that signals that we are now living in a police state. So if you look at the covert human intelligence sources bill, which in effect means that the police and the intelligence agencies are able to commit any crime against private citizens without exception. There is no without caveat. Whereas in the past this used to be, for the ambiguous term national security, this can also be used in terms of protecting the UK economy from harm. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean a trade unionist trying to organise a general strike or to protect, to prevent public disorder? What does that mean? Does it mean, torturing or even killing, somebody sure. who's looking to raise, a subject matter that impacts them? So I think that it's hollowing out our civil liberties, and it's going to impact our freedoms. In fact, there's probably things that we haven't even anticipated at this moment in time. And one thing I perhaps didn't mention when we're talking about the different aspects of the law is this ASBO, really, that if somebody's been to protests that haven't been approved of, and, two protests, I think it is, in the last 5 years, this bill will prevent them from not only being able to attend protests, but also being able to encourage people on social media or elsewhere to attend protests.
Right.
It's deeply concerning.
Sure, of course, because they don't want you to spread the word or trying to gather people, whether it's through social media means or otherwise. And you talked about other legislation that's being debated, and I have to ask you about this one because this has raised eyebrows and shocked many, Chris Williamson, and that is the Nationality and Borders Bill, which, among other provisions, it would allow government to strip people of their British citizenship. When you take a look at that, and they can do that without notice, it seems like. What is your impression of that? I mean, when you add up all these different things that are happening in the UK, of laws that are going to be passed or will be passed, it really does come down to perhaps what our guest there, Natalie, has said.
Very controversial, and you'd think, given the scandal of the what happened to the Windrush generation, where we saw children who'd lived here all their lives virtually but didn't have papers and weren't able to necessarily prove that they got British citizenship, were being deported back to the Caribbean. Absolutely outrageous, and this caused huge controversy when it eventually came to light a few years ago now. And yet here we are with this new legislation which is being put through, which is kind of a repetition and actually even worse than potentially what happened to the Windrush generation. And people are right to be fearful about the implication of this. But, as well, Natalie mentioned it, and I can't help but to refer back to the point about the covert human intelligence sources bill, and because that actually, and there was an attempt by the opposition in the House of Commons to exclude, because it gives agents of the state the right to commit criminal conduct. And there was an attempt in the House of Commons to limit that criminal conduct, to prevent it from being used to rape, torture or murder people. That could not be done under the basis of this criminal human intelligence sources legislation. And that was voted down. So it seems to me the government is essentially therefore giving the green light to murder, rape and torture people. I mean, what, this is unbelievable. What is happening? It's outrageous. And so, yes, I mean, the repressive legislation which is being pushed through and which isn't being resisted sufficiently vigorously enough by the official opposition in the House of Commons, or indeed being reported upon by the corporate media, by the Fourth Estate, they're doing an incredible disservice.
Sure.
To the people of this nation. And that's why public protest is so important, to actually raise these issues, because we are being ill-served by the media and by our parliamentarians, who should be there to actually hold the executive, to hold the government to account, to stop these repressive measures being pushed through. Britain used to sort of pride itself on its democratic traditions, on spreading democracy around the world, and yet
indeed
here we are in a situation where more and more repressive legislation is being pushed through almost on a kind of a monthly basis now. It's quite shocking, and it's really important that we do everything we can, I think, to mobilize opposition to it.
Sure. Who knows? Maybe next time around we can't even debate this on a media program like this one. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but let me thank both of you, human rights activists and campaigner Natalie Stryker. Thank you so much for your thoughts. And former British MP Chris Williamson there from Derby, UK. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kovat Tahveh, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Suratul Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَإِذَا أُلْقُوا مِنْهَا مَكَانًا ضَيِّقًا مُقَرَّنِينَ دَعَوْا هُنَالِكَ ثُبُورًا
And when they are thrown into a narrow place therein bound in chains, they will cry out thereupon for destruction.
As you have been with us, we were talking about the couple of verses in chapter Furqan discussing the different chastisements of the pagans in hereafter. In the 11th verse, the Almighty Allah said that because of their denial of the hour of resurrection, we have prepared a blazing fire for them. In the 12th verse, it was said, إِذَا رَأَتْهُم مِّن مَكَانٍ بَعِيدٍ سَمِعُوا لَهَا تَغَيُّضًا وَزَفِيرًا When it sees them from a far place, they will hear its raging and roaring. And now, the 13th verse starts saying, وَإِذَا أُلْقُوا مِنْهَا مَكَانًا ضَيِّقًا مُقَرَّنِينَ دَعَوْا هُنَالِكَ ثُبُورًا And when they are cast, coupled in fetters, into a narrow place of that fire, they will call out there for destruction. The word مُقَرَّنِينَ means to fasten with fetter and chain. The word thubur also, da'u hunalika thubura, means to express regret. Now, in the previous verse, it was mentioned how the condition of the pagans and how the condition of fire is when the fire sees those pagans from a long distance. But this verse, the 13th one, describes the condition of the pagans when they are in the hellfire. So, in the previous verse, they were afar and they were only hearing the raging and roaring fire, but now this is the description, this is what situation they are in the hellfire. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew. Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So at first it says, إِذَا أُلْقُوا مِنْهَا مَكَانًا ضَيِّقًا مُقَرَّنِينَ. When they are cast coupled in fetters into a narrow place of fire, دَعَوْ هُنَالِكَ ثُبُورًا. They will call out there for destruction. This is not because the hellfire is small. The hell, according to the 13th verse of chapter Qaf, and also from our other traditions, we can understand that the hell is never filled up. The Holy Quran says, on the day when we say to hell, are you filled up? It says, are there any more? هَلْ امْتَلَأْتِ فَيَقُولْ هَلْ مِنْ مَزِيدٍ. Are there any more? So, hell is not the problem for these pagans is not that the hell is small. The problem is with this vast place for the wrongdoers, the ones that the previous verses described, these pagans are having a quiet, narrow place. Hell is a very vast place, but they are so confined in it that in some narration, we read that their entrance into hell is like entering a nail into a wall. This is how narrow and confined their path in hell is. And this is the consequence of not believing in hereafter. Ignorance from the Almighty Allah, both in this world and hereafter, has got some consequences. In this world, the Almighty Allah says, يَجْعَلْ صَدْرَهُ ضَيِّقًا حَرَجًا. The Almighty Allah makes his chest tight and confined. Or elsewhere in the Holy Quran we read, وَمَنْ أَعْرَضَ عَنْ ذِكْرِي فَإِنَّ لَهُ مَعِيشَةً ضَنْكَ. The one who turns away from my remembrance, his sustenance will be really confined and narrow. And this is what happens in hereafter. إِذَا أُلْقُوا مِنْهَا مَكَانًا ضَيِّقًا مُقَرَّنِينَ. When they are cast in fetters into a narrow place of fire, دعوا هنالك ثبورا. They will call out there for destruction. Also, the word ثبور, we said that it means to express woe and regret, but we have to know that it originally means decay and destruction. But when a man fears from something really terrible or horrific, he cries, woe to me from such a fearsome scene. We are done with the 13th verse of the chapter, dear listeners. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdollahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year Comprehensive Strategic Cooperation Agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then-Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks, aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018, after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Wuxi.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer. Do star jumps or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier to British households. Some of the Britons we talked to had this to say in response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mold, damp and excessive cold anyway with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse, so...
It's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saeed Purza, London.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
. 82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions, be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life. A whole range of conditions, vaccine hesitancy and scepticism is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean community.
But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they say they don't know what's in it. They said they don't know what's in it, and it makes some people sick. Because me, when I had it, I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. He's not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week, he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. and people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now. You see, a lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something, I don't know. But for me, no.
The black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic. That we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's foreign minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange. Qasimi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together, to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the yellow vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated